Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Strange Familiars, the Neighbors Mowing Edition.
You could just call that the Summer Edition. Why they chose to do it starting pretty much at twilight, it's their call, I guess.
Yeah.
The vindictive side of me might want to start mowing at 3 a.m., but...
I'll tie some flashlights to the front of the push mower. On tonight's show, I will be talking with Mr. W.T. Watson. I know him as Travis, but his books are written under the name of W.T. Watson. We're going to be talking about two of his books, Mysteries in the Mist, and his new book, Canadian Monsters and Mysteries.
Is Red Green involved?
Absolutely. The number one cryptid in Canada.
He is sort of a proto-flannel man.
Before we get to Travis, I want to remind everybody that one of our listeners, longtime supporters, Maynard, is seeking help. He's got a lot of hospital bills. He hurt himself, couldn't walk, had to get surgery, and had to go back in and get another surgery. We have a GoFundMe link that we put up last week in the show notes. We'll put it up again this week. If you can afford to help Maynard, go ahead and click on that link. Every little bit helps. And speaking of Maynard, you know, Maynard's a patron, right?
Mm-hmm. This is going to be a seamless segue.
Right into the Patreon. You may notice that today's episode number is 332. Mm-hmm. And if you get your podcast through just a podcatcher, if you're not a patron, the last podcast you got from us
129.
Was 329.
Yeah. Not 129. That would be back a couple of years. So if I'm doing the math correctly, that's a two-episode difference.
It's a two-episode gap. And you might be saying to yourself, where did those two episodes go?
Do they not know sequential mathematics?
Why was 329 the last episode I got? And 332 is this episode.
I got it. Missing time.
Possibly.
Yeah.
But.
They could be patrons.
There you are. Patron episodes. Patrons got two episodes in between last week and this week. Patrons get two full extra episodes of Strange Familiars every month. We don't often drop them in the same week. It just happened to work out that way for this month. If you like what we do and you want to get extra content, you want to help us make Strange Familiars, the best way to support the show is by becoming a patron at Patreon. It's patreon.com/strangefamiliars. There's different tiers of support there, and there's options to pay monthly or to pay yearly, and you get an even bigger discount if you want to pay yearly. But all of our patrons, no matter what tier support they choose, they get those two full extra episodes of Strange Familiars every month. And of course, I want to thank our patrons because we could not do Strange Familiars without them. Well, let's go ahead and get to my talk with Mr. W.T. Watson. I'd like to welcome Travis Watson back to the show. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. A little late for us old folks, but you know, got to do what you got to do, right?
Well, I'm a night bird. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no worries. No worries. I'm going to probably end up doing more nighttime stuff anyway, so I better get used to it.
We're going to talk tonight about a couple of your books. You were on before for your Black Dog book. What was the title of the Black Dog book? Sorry, I'm blanking on it.
Phantom Black Dogs, Walkers of the Liminal Way.
Yes, which I really enjoyed, and I equally enjoyed Mysteries in the Mist, which we're going to talk a little bit about tonight, and then we're going to segue into a newer book that you've recently published. Trying to keep up with you. I'm having trouble here.
Yeah, well, I'm slowing down a little bit now. It's the next one's not due until December, so you know, you guys will all get a chance to take a breath before you have to talk to me again.
my goal is a book a year, and sometimes I can meet that, and sometimes I can't. But
yeah, well, you know, I know you have a super busy life, and you know, I'm sure that doing the podcast takes up a lot of the time too. So the other book, the one we're talking about tonight, mostly is Mysteries in the Mist, Mist, Fog, Clouds, and the Paranormal. I just published Canadian Monsters and Mysteries, all with Beyond the Fray, as with all of my other books. So that one came about as a result of my actually having moved to Canada. My partner got a job at the University of Waterloo, and we moved up here a couple of years ago. And of course, being the oddball that I am, I had to see, well, what kinds of strange things are available in Canada? And I discovered that there's quite a lot of paranormal goodness up here. So I got working on that book too, and it came together pretty quickly. And so that one just launched a couple of weeks ago.
And you have an author page on Amazon?
People can
find your stuff? Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. And of course, we'll put some links in the show notes so anybody can find you that way as well. Mysteries in the Mist. Obviously, and very plainly, this is about mist, smoke, and fog in paranormal accounts across the board. Mm-hmm. It's such a ubiquitous part of it that a lot of these accounts, even the ones I was familiar with, I was like, oh yeah, yeah, there was fog in that. Oh yeah, there was a mist in that account. You know, it's so ubiquitous that you almost need to take a step back and look at it specifically as, you know, in these mist and fog type events.
Yeah, you're actually partially responsible for this book because you'll remember when I was on talking to you about Phantom Black Dogs the last time, we got talking about signs of a paranormal incursion. And we were talking about Jenny Randall's Oz effect and the silence that descends, the time distortion, the feeling that something's going to happen. And you were talking about anomalous lights as a sign for some incursions and a couple of other things. And I had done a lot of interviews, quite a number of interviews on the Phantom Black Dog book. And I got to thinking, you know, there were several accounts in that book that had fog in them. And so I was wondering to myself as we were sitting there that night if, you know, these mists, fogs, clouds, and so forth were actually signs of paranormal incursion, you know, something else that one might look for. And I went down that rabbit hole, and this book is the result. And so I have to thank you for, you know, being a partial inspiration for the book. There were several things that came up that gave me the idea, but being on this show also was something that got me going on the research for this. And as you can see from the book, it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's in every aspect of the paranormal, from cryptid stories, you know, Sasquatch and Dogman stories, to ghost stories, to UFO encounters, to things that we can't really put a label on, but they involve clouds and, you know, clouds doing strange things. The research for this one was really mind-blowing for me.
It's one of those books that, you know, which I love. I love these. It's like, somebody probably should have written this 20 years ago, but it, you know, they didn't. So it's a really cool thing. It's just like, yeah, it's, you know, this is, like I said, it's just all over the phenomena. It's great to see it approached like this. I really enjoy your approach.
Well, I thank you. You know, and again, I don't know why someone hasn't done this previously, but about the closest I've seen anybody come was Jenny Randles with some of her work in ufology and you know, the whole, that, as I said, that idea of specific effects accompanying, in her case, she was talking about UFO phenomena, but other writers have kind of expanded that out to include other paranormal phenomena. But I would have thought, given the, as you said, the prevalence, the ubiquity of mist, fogs, clouds in the paranormal, that somebody would have picked up on it before. I guess I was just, you know, in the right place at the right time.
About a decade ago, I remember seeing like a spate of stories that popped up about sentient mists. And I remember thinking like, this is going to be, you know, the next kind of Slender Man or whatever the you know trend of the moment is, because I kept seeing
whatever
it.
The thing of the week is.
Yeah. I kept seeing it. And then it just kind of, no pun intended, faded out. Like,
yeah. And, you know, I've included some stories in the book that, I don't know if you'd so much call them sentient mists, but they're certainly mists with a very particular effect, which can range from, you know, somebody driving into the cloud and disappearing completely, as happened to, there was a group of Japanese businessmen who were driving off to play golf, and a car passed them on the road that they were on, drove into a cloud and didn't come out the other side. I think that was a John Keel story, if I remember right. It's been a while since I did the research on this. You know, there are probably my favorite, you know, sort of mist having an effect and we don't know what caused it. The story was, I call it the anti-gravity mist. Young man is riding a motorcycle in Great Britain, and it is a rainy, wet summer, apparently, and he is soaked to the skin and he's trying to get home. He sees, here's your anomalous light phenomenon, he sees a purple light behind him. And he thinks that, oh, well, there must be a car closing on me or about to pass me. And, you know, of course, it's dark, and being on a motorcycle, he's being extra careful. So he's watching for this vehicle, and nothing catches him up until a little later a Jaguar motor car comes along and does go past him. About the time that car goes past him, they both encounter a cloud that has purple highlights in it, which, you know, one of the things I say repeatedly now is, if you see a cloud that is not a natural color, do not go into this cloud unless you want to have a paranormal encounter. So this young fellow drives into this cloud, and, you know, classic effect, his bike dies immediately. And you would think, you know, he would coast to a stop, but he doesn't. He continues on up the hill. Whatever is this effect of this cloud is, it pulls him and the Jaguar motor car, both of which are dead, neither one of which will run, pulls both of them up the hill, not only up the hill, but over the top of the hill. And then it dissipates. And as soon as it dissipates, both vehicles are capable of starting. The young man notices that the gas tank for his bike is warm, and he realizes that he is now bone dry. You know, what do? You start your bike up and you go on your way, and you go home and wonder what the heck just happened to me.
Yeah.
But that was one of my favorite stories from the book. I just, you know, there are tons of really interesting encounters, but that one just really stuck with me for whatever reason. I can sympathize with the, you know, the riding a motorcycle and being soaking wet. I've done that as a young man.
I think my favorite, personal favorite, was in the teleportation section, where people were being teleported by mist. And it was a fellow, I believe he was in China, and he ended up 300 miles away. And a couple weeks, I think, too, right?
Yeah, if I recall, yes, this was a time period before, you know, there were motor vehicles and airplanes and all that sort of thing. If I remember right, it was in the 1800s in China. And, you know, as you may know from cultural studies, the, you know, the Chinese peasant who was a farmer didn't leave their plot of land for any length of time. However, this gentleman encountered a cloud in his fields, and was apparently teleported to another location, approximately 300 some miles away, and it took him some time to get back to his plot of land. You just don't do that. You know, there's no reason why someone would do a hoax like that, because, you know, if you leave your plot untended for any length of time, you know, it's going to affect your harvest and may affect your ability to feed your family and,
sure,
you know, pay your taxes, and all kinds of effects may follow on from that. So this fella had a legitimate experience, apparently, and he ended up someplace where he wasn't before, and he had no idea how he got there. And as so often happens with these teleportation events, if the person comes out somewhere where, you know, we can find them, you know, he went to the local authorities and said, "I don't know where I am. You know,
right.
I don't know what's going on. And, you know, I need help." You see the same thing with some of the South American cases where, you know, a doctor and his wife drive into a cloud in Argentina, I believe, and end up in Mexico. And, you know, they contact the local constabulary because they have no idea where they are, and discover that they're, you know, 1,000 or more kilometers away from where they were when they started.
Wow. Was there missing time in that? I know in the Chinese case, it was a considerable bit of missing time. But
considerable bit of time in the Chinese case. There was almost no missing time in the doctor case.
Wow.
There is another one, same area, and I'm drawing a blank on the name of the area now, but this fellow was a business person, came out of a hotel, had just checked out of his hotel, got into his new car. This cloud appears from nowhere. Next thing this fellow knows, he is in some other part of the country, several hundred kilometers away. He flags down a truck and gets a ride into town, goes to the constabulary, to the local police force. They, of course, don't believe him, so they call the town that he had been in. The cops there go to the hotel and find his car sitting outside the hotel still running.
Oh, wow.
So he lost no time,
wow,
but he ended up, you know, like hundreds of kilometers away. I mean, and this was in the 50s, right? There was no possible way that he could have bridged the gap from where he was to where he ended up in the time period that he did. I mean, there weren't even aircraft that would go that fast.
Wow.
So he's like, okay. So of course he has to find a way to get back to where he started. And those are the lucky ones, because they actually ended up someplace where they could find their way back.
Right. You know?
We don't know what happens to some of the people who disappear into these clouds. You know, that then you go into the whole, you know, disappeared into fairyland and ne'er between shall me.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, some of those teleportation stories were just wild.
It's just so bizarre. And you think, like, you know, I'm not a nuts and bolts UFO guy, just as I'm not a flesh and blood Bigfoot guy. But you think with, like, if someone has missing time, then okay, and no memory, like, okay, maybe something happened that they weren't aware of in that time period.
Mm-hmm.
If it's just an, you know, almost instant teleportation, that just seems like a practical joke from the other, you know?
It's like the intelligence behind these things said, ha-ha, gotcha.
Yeah.
The thing that I always wonder, though, when I read these things is, why this guy?
Right, right.
You know, why this, you know, Joe business dude who's out, you know, selling his stuff or whatever it is he was doing, he's going from place to place, having business meetings and so forth, and this wild, completely wild thing happens to him. Why this guy?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what is it about this person that attracted the attention of the other?
Right, yeah.
You know, what is it about the person, their energy, or whatever that attracted this bizarre event? Or what was it about them that needed this bizarre event to happen?
Yes.
Yeah. This is one of the things that I often wonder about when you talk to paranormal witnesses. Of course, you know, people are like, oh, well, you know, this thing happened to me, blah, blah, blah. We don't get to see a lot of times, unless, I mean, you probably have, because I know that you've had witnesses that you followed up with over the course of time, mm-hmm. but we often don't get to see what happens after. What kind of effect does this sort of thing have on a person's life? Yeah. Do they just go, oh, well, this really weird thing happened to me, and then they go on with their life? Or is it an initiatic event for them that makes them aware of the other and makes them curious about it and you know, leads them into maybe a place they needed to be in?
Yes, I think often people are changed by this stuff. You can't speak in absolutes when it comes to the paranormal. Never.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, so,
never,
so ever. This is absolutely not an absolute. But I've kind of had an idea, you know, and try not to have confirmation bias about this, but it's a thought that I've had that often these really extreme encounters where people are really scared, really terrified by things, seem to be happening. Again, this is just my limited experience with people I've talked to. Often to people who have been like, I never believed in any of this at all. Mm-hmm. It's almost like they weren't ready for it, and it comes out and slaps them across the face, you know, metaphorically speaking, and it really rocks their world because mm-hmm. in no way were they prepared to, you know, monsters are real or, you know, whatever, ghosts are real, whatever it is, whatever event mm-hmm. it is, UFOs. And often, I'm, you know, again, I can't talk in absolutes, but often it seems like it's these people that have lived this like very materialist kind of idea of life that mm-hmm. Struggle with the after effects of these.
Yeah, I mean, I see that even in the you know, the flesh and blood Bigfoot people or the nuts and bolts, you know, extraterrestrial craft people, UFO people, that, you know, it's one thing when you're talking about the experience, you're trying to investigate the experience and so forth, but it's another thing when you have an experience. And a lot of times it will change people's opinions, or if it doesn't change their opinion entirely, it softens their opinion.
Yeah.
So that they're a little more willing to accept alternate points of view.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something about this that's somehow tied in with the human experience. That's mm-hmm. I've said it's been with us forever and probably will be in one form or another.
And it keeps evolving.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the things that I point out to people who, again, you got the whole nuts and bolts thing with UFOs. You know, everybody's like, oh, it's an extraterrestrial craft from a highly advanced technological civilization. But in my Canadian Monsters book, I have several reports where UFOs just basically screw up. You know, my favorite is there's a nuclear power station on Lake Ontario, and in the 60s or 70s, I don't remember exact dates, but this actually rated a log entry that there was a unidentified craft spotted out over the lake near the plant. Witnesses at the plant testified that the UFO dropped something into the water. And then they testified that the dang thing kept coming back every couple of days and seemed to be looking for whatever it was that dropped in the water. It's like, now, come on, seriously. If you're talking about a highly advanced technological civilization, A, why would they need to drop a probe?
Right.
I mean, wouldn't they have the scanners and sensors and things that they need to be able to determine whatever it is they want to know about that plant? And even if they did, why would they not be able to find it later?
Yeah. You have a similar example in Mysteries in the Mist. It's a UFO that drops a ladder down. And I'm reading the story and it didn't occur. But then, you know, in your commentary afterwards, you're like, now why would this highly advanced culture from outer space need a ladder to get down from the ship? Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic point. Absolutely fantastic.
Or you have the situation that there's a great story in Mysteries in the Mist where young lady is vacationing. It's in Australia, I believe. Vacationing, a nice villa type of setup on the coast of Australia, sitting and she's reading a book or something, looks out and there's a beautiful pink cloud off on the horizon as the sun is going down. She thinks that's very lovely and she goes back to doing whatever she's doing. She looks up a few minutes later and the cloud is closer to her. So she's like, that's odd. And she goes out. She's on a cliff, sort of looking out over the ocean, right? She's looking out at this cloud, and she realizes that this cloud is actually basically surrounding and disguising this UFO that's approaching the shore. And she's looking down at this thing. So if she'd been standing on the beach, she'd have been looking up, and all she would have seen would have been a cloud.
Right.
But because she had a different vantage point, she could see the craft itself, this whatever it is. So this thing comes to the beach. It lands on the beach. And basically, I can't remember whether it was a flare or what it was, but it signals. It does a light signal of some kind. And that signal is acknowledged by something off in the distance. And then the humanoid or whatever gets back in the craft and flies off and goes off toward this signal.
Right.
It's like, seriously, they couldn't find each other without shooting flares or whatever? Why the hell does a UFO need to stop, park over a lake, and drop a hose in?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, so these are all things that I've encountered in my research, and it's enough to make me go, okay, well, I think there's something more going on here, something stranger going on here than just some interstellar craft flying to planet Earth. Because seriously, highly advanced technological civilization, what possible use could they have for a bunch of, featherless bipedal apes, who are pretty much intent on killing each other all the time anyway? It's a known aggressive species. Why would you even mess with them? If you wanted to do scientific studies of them, you do it from orbit, right?
One would think. Certainly, I'm already in that camp. You didn't have to convince me, but it was excellent points when you just point out how silly some of these contraptions are for, supposedly advanced interstellar space people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and then you go back to the early days of UFOs, and you have the airships with their pancakes and stuff.
Oh, yeah. I love the airship stories. I absolutely love them.
Oh, I love those. I love them. They stop and, drop ropes down and rope ladders down and climb down and have dinner with people stuff. It's just great.
Oh, fantastic stuff. And someone else pointed out that UFOs are always a couple steps ahead of us technology-wise. So these airship reports are right before we develop airships.
Right. And then, you get into, the World War II era, and you get the Foo Fighters, and you get the ghost rockets. Then you get flying saucers, and then it evolves into these giant triangle craft that have been flying around. And
right before we get the stealth bomber.
They're just all... Yeah, and they're always just a little bit ahead of where we are, but not so far ahead. The thing that really sets them apart is their performance. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they can do things in our gravity that we could possibly as human beings do, but it's always just a little bit ahead of where we might be.
So to give folks an idea of what you cover in here, if you don't mind, can I ask for your favorite story from each section? You've done the press for this for quite a bit before talking with me. Let's go through each section. If anything jumps out for you, a story jumps out for you, we can talk about it.
I can tell you that, as far as the cryptid section goes, I think that probably one of my favorite stories is one that most people probably haven't heard of. It's a Welsh derivative of the Sasquatch phenomena. The Welsh name for this, which I wouldn't even attempt to pronounce because I know I would slaughter it, translates to something like Monarch of the Mists. In the legend of this being, I'm going to call it a being because I don't really think of this one as a creature because it strikes me as being a very earth spirit sort of thing.
Sure.
But this creature, this being is supposed to inhabit the mists on certain mountainous crags or craggy mountains in Wales. And it's said that, if you displease it, and you're climbing one of these mountains, you're in trouble because it wouldn't hesitate to throw you off the mountain if it really, really wanted to. So the Monarch of the Mist has a kind of a mixed reputation as being, you know, a rather fierce guardian of the mountains that it's a part of. The interesting story to me is there's a town that's not too far from the mountainous areas of Wales, where this fellow who was a factory worker or something along that line was walking his dog, as so often happens in paranormal stories. He's walking his dog, and his dog starts to do the characteristic, "Oh my God, there's something in the bushes. Help Dad," hiding behind his feet and that sort of thing. He looks up and he sees what he describes as a gorilla in the bush. Now, of course, gorillas are not indigenous to Wales in any way, shape, or form. He says that it was a gorilla, or like a Yeti, is exactly how he describes it, as a Yeti. And this thing makes enough of an impression on him that he actually notifies the local police. And the really interesting part of the story is that the local crime prevention officer gives a quote to the local newspaper that says, "We take these Yeti reports very seriously, and we'll be increasing patrols in this area." Now, that made me think, well, gosh, how many times do we get Yeti reports in this area that right. They're just so nonchalant about it? I enjoyed that story because of the police angle to it. And, you know, the fellow saying, well, you know, we get these Yetis and, you know, we take them very seriously because we don't want them harming our citizens or anything.
I am always, I thought that was, always fascinated by Sasquatch-like things in UK, Scotland, and Ireland.
Yeah. You know, and I do, of course, tell the story of the Grey Man of Moh Dhuibh, too, in the book, because that's a classic myth story where, you know, you have a lot of the people that have encounters with the Grey Man. First of all, Moh Dhuibh is a I think it's the second highest mountain in Scotland. And there is the legend of the Grey Man, who is supposed to be the creature on this mountain. There are several different accounts from various mountaineers over time. And most of those accounts have what you've called, I believe, in the past, the forced poltergeist phenomena. Mm-hmm. You know, so the person will hear footsteps, they'll have, rocks moving, there will be general movement. They don't see anything in the mist normally, but they have this overwhelming sense of panic and they bail out away from the mountain. They go flying down the side of the mountain. In the last story that I tell, though, fellas up there, it's either during or shortly after World War II. I think it was during World War II, actually. He's up there, food is short in that time period, so he figures that he takes a pistol with him because he figures he might bag something for dinner that night because there are grouse and so forth up on the mountain. He, again, as with a lot of these experiences, has that sort of poltergeistish phenomena going on around him. He hears footsteps. He feels he's being followed. He feels he's being watched. He's becoming increasingly distressed. In this case, though, he says that a large humanoid figure, rose up out of the mist and came toward him. And, you know, he opens fire on this thing to no effect, as often happens in these cases. And then, like everybody else, bails out down the mountain. Now, the semi-miraculous thing in all of these stories is that every one of these people that had these encounters made it off the mountain. In a mist, in the fog, on a treacherous mountainside, you know, as a former search and rescue volunteer, one of the things that we would tell you if you got lost on a mountainside is to sit the heck down, you know, and don't move until you can see where you're going.
Right.
These guys all bailed off the side of this mountain in the fog, you know, very minimal visibility, and all of them made it off of the mountain. So you have to wonder if the Grey Man was kind of like, okay, I chased you off your mountain, but I don't want to kill you.
Right.
Go that way. So, those are great stories too.
Oh, yeah.
And the evidence of this creature being or whatever is the same kind of evidence that you would see people putting forward for the Bigfoot Sasquatch here in North America. You know, they hear sounds. There's that feeling of being watched, the footsteps, and there may have been some rock throwing or rock clacking or something like that. I don't remember, but those are all things that, you know, your Sasquatch researchers will say, oh yeah, there's definitely a Sasquatch in the area, except it's on a mountain in Great Britain.
Right. Yeah.
You know, where everybody says, oh well, you couldn't have Sasquatches because there's not enough forest there. You know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, hard to imagine a breeding population anywhere in the UK, Scotland, Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. But they have encounters, you know.
But there are encounters.
Yeah, very believable ones as well.
Which makes you wonder, you know, well, you know, I mean, it goes back to the whole, you know, where the footprints end thing, you know, where this thing is coming from.
Yeah, yeah. Where does it come from and where does it go? That's the
and where did it go?
That's the big questions. Yeah.
Why did the tracks start in one place and end in another place, and you can't figure out where it came from and where it went?
Yep, exactly.
And why are the tracks on the roof of your house?
I mean, that's a big one for me. The things on roofs. I don't know if there's a whole book in that, but it is again something else that's ubiquitous across these different reports throughout the ages. And that was one of the big things for me. The two big things for me that kind of moved me vastly away from the flesh and blood thing was finding these folkloric reports of these just odd things from Europe that they're saying. One of the traits they said is, oh, it will get up and walk on your roof. Like, what an odd detail. The second was glowing red eyes, which you find in fairies and trolls and vampires and werewolves and everything.
And the interesting thing to me is you know, if you start to cross-reference into other paranormal areas, you know, you read Linda Godfrey's work, she's got several stories about these dogmen creatures or whatever being on roofs.
Mm-hmm.
If you read the Navajo, Diné people, their accounts of skinwalker encounters frequently start with this thing walking around on their roof.
Sure.
It's definitely a thing. And, you know, it's something, again, that bears further, because you have three separate phenomena, but they're doing the same thing. Why?
Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Things are far stranger than some folks would like to believe.
Yeah.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
So in section two, in Mysteries in the Mist, you cover what you call Phantoms of the Mist, which is a really broad category. I just want to ask you, in amongst this, is, you know, vampires and ghosts and shadow people, et cetera, et cetera. But I want to ask you, in your terminology, when referring to fairy, you simply call them the folk. Now, I've heard people say that they, being, you know, the fairies, do not like that name. Is that Is that why you chose that terminology?
Not particularly. The thing about that realm is that the strictures that people placed on themselves in relationship to those beings vary wildly according to culture, area, geography, et cetera, et cetera. So in one place, you might have them referred to as those ones. Some people will call them the people of peace. Some people will call them the fair folk. There's as many names for the fae as there are, or the fairy, as there are, the different kinds of people out there.
Sure.
I didn't consciously use that name to be adversarial. I certainly don't have an adversarial relationship with the fae. You come to a point where there's only so many times you can say fae, fairy,
true folk, enough.
You know, whatever, you know, you just
true enough. Yeah.
You just kind of start looking for another synonym.
Sure.
So, and there are some people that refer to them as the folk or the fair folk or whatever.
Yeah,
so I felt it was fair game, and I didn't feel anybody got particularly insulted about that.
Oh, so. No. I thought you were doing it as a sort of precautionary compliment to the fae, because like I said, I've had people email me and said, they don't like being called that. You shouldn't call them that.
Well, I have had experience with the fae. I've taken seminars with a noted fairy seer. I think if I was going to tick off the fair folk, I would have done it by now. So, and I haven't certainly had any experience of them being ticked off about this book. In fact, they seem to kind of enjoy the fact that, you know, I'm digging up Canadian Monsters and Mysteries has a whole section your friend Joshua Cutchin is excited about, because I went to Barbara Yates' book on the fairy in Newfoundland and based a whole section on that book, which he apparently loved a great deal. It was one of his things that he really enjoyed in his research. So, but yeah, I talk a good bit about the fae, because they are known to cloak themselves in mist, basically as a form of escape. A lot of times, you know, people see them and then they disappear into the mist. And mist is often associated with fairy sightings. But yeah, there were a whole lot of other things that made it into that phantom section too, that there's all kinds of examples of, you know, well, of course, ghosts are very traditionally associated with the mist.
Yes.
And I give a couple of examples of that. The phantom black dogs, as I said, that was one of the things that got me going on this research.
Sure.
Because there's that one classic black dog story where one of the first editors for the Oxford English Dictionary was on holiday in Great Britain with his family, and they went hiking, and again, they got socked in by fog. And again, they're wandering around on a mountainside in the fog, which is not a high percentage move. This large black dog appears to them and, basically refuses to let the father go any further than he'd already gone. And when the fog dissipated, along with the black dog, they realized that if they had gone farther, they would have gone off a precipice. Mm. So the classic phantom black dog is guardian story.
Right. Yeah.
One of my favorite black dog tales. That one and the I had a whole section in the black dog book about, you know, what happens when you shoot at a black dog, which is basically nothing.
Right.
There's a tale in the book about a young man who's out walking in the fog, and he hears the black dog coming. I don't know if it's baying or if he just hears the footsteps or what the deal was with that. But he hears the black dog coming, and he beats feet for the house. He gets back to his house, and he pounds on the door. His father opens the door, and he gets inside, and he's like all shook up, because he's heard this thing baying and so forth. And of course, a lot of people in the UK associate the black dog with impending death, so you don't want to encounter one, really. So, interestingly, the old guy seems to be made of sterner stuff. He goes up to the second floor of the house, and he looks out the window, and sure enough, there's a black dog down in his front yard, and he's not having that. So he goes and gets his fowling piece. The shotgun for shooting birds, right? Mm-hmm. And he unloads on this thing. He drops about probably five or six rounds of ammunition at this black dog. It has no effect whatsoever, other than the fact that their outhouse is very thoroughly ventilated when they go out the next morning. These creatures are apparitional enough to where you're not going to shoot one and bring it down.
I definitely want to talk about some Canadian monsters. So that's just real quickly. Section 3 is all UFOs. You have three parts on UFOs, one part on abduction. I just want to mention what I thought was a fabulous case that I had never heard. It's where they are flying in a plane. I think it was a prop plane, if I'm remembering correctly. And they basically fly into this cloud, and they described it almost like custard, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It coated the entire plane, and their gauges and such wouldn't work. The electronics, they stayed flying, so it didn't cut off.
Right.
But
all of their electronic instruments, all of their magnetic instruments, everything was completely useless.
Yeah.
And remained useless until they actually flew out of the cloud. And the interesting part about that story is that, and there's another similar one that we can talk about. The interesting thing about that story is that once they cleared the cloud, they discovered that they had a slight teleportation experience because they were farther along their route than they should have been.
Mm.
They were much closer to, I think it was Daytona Beach, than they should have been, according to the flight time, the cruising speed, and so forth, the aircraft that they were flying in. They had some moments of panic and then cleared the cloud. And as soon as they cleared the cloud and could get their bearings again, they realized that they were much closer to their destination than they would have been if they had been flying a normal pattern. So that was interesting.
Yeah, it's such a bizarre account and such a bizarre detail. That's one of those bizarre details where you're like, could someone have even made that up? The idea that it coated the plane like custard. Like, what a bizarre detail.
Yeah, it's like, okay, yeah. So clouds that look like custard go on the list of things to avoid, too.
Sure, yeah.
yeah, because, you know, there were some stories of ocean-going vessels, too, that encountered these fogs. And, you know, the fog was so thick that the one that I'm thinking of was a ship that was towing a barge. They went into the cloud. You know, basically the ship, you know, steered into the cloud and lost power. The engines began to lose power almost immediately. And they had a double of the time getting out of this cloud. They did finally succeed in clearing the major fog bank, basically. And the captain ordered some of the crew to go and check on the barge. And when they went to check on the barge, when they put their hands on the side of the barge, it was actually warm to the touch, kind of like the gas tank I was telling you about earlier.
Right.
Something that happens, you know, frequently. But during the time period that they were in this cloud, they lost all instrumentation. They had no way to navigate. They couldn't see anything. They couldn't dead reckon anything. They just basically had to point the boat in a direction and try to motor out of it. Which was difficult because the engines were failing, mm-hmm. but they did finally manage to get out. But you wonder what would have happened if they hadn't.
Right.
Get any number of disappearances at sea. You know, everybody talks about, oh, well, you know, the whole Bermuda Triangle thing, right? You know, the ship disappears and there's no trace of it, or the plane disappears and there's no trace of it. You know, if you have particularly with an aircraft, if you have a situation like the one that happened to Martin. His first name was Martin, and I can't remember his last name. It's the guy that wrote Cyborg, which was the novel that the $6 Million Man was based on.
Yeah.
Caden, something like that. Navy pilot flying with a whole ton of other Navy pilots on a highly, you know, technically advanced naval aircraft coming back over the Atlantic. Again, passes into one of these clouds. They lose all instrumentation, all of their electronic countermeasures, everything. The whole plane just goes except for the engines. And, you know, only the fact that the pilots were all, you know, like, you know, top-level aviators, they managed to keep this plane in the air. But if you had less experienced pilots, that plane probably would have gone down somewhere, and who knows where it would have gone down. You know, you wouldn't even know where to look for it.
Right. Yeah.
Because there was no radio communication. All of the instruments, all of the radio communication, all the satellite stuff, everything that they used for navigation and tracking and all that stuff was dead. It was gone. So it would make it much easier for a plane to just disappear.
Section 4, just for our listeners, we're going to move on to the monsters here, but Section 4 covers mysterious myths, time slips, teleportation, and disappearances. I know people always like the missing 411 type stuff. So there's a couple sections on disappearances. And Section 5 is your kind of miscellaneous. It's kind of things that don't fit in the other sections, but still plenty of weirdness to go through there.
Yeah, but still had plenty of clouds and weird things to have happen. Yes.
Oh, yeah. So that's Mysteries in the Mist, Mist Fog, and Clouds in the Paranormal. And the new book, which I don't have in front of me, it's so new that I don't have it here. What's the title of this again?
It's called Canadian Monsters and Mysteries. And as I mentioned earlier, I moved to Canada a couple of years ago. And of course, being the odd fellow that I am, I had to start to explore the odd side of Canada. And I quickly found that there's all kinds of interesting stuff, paranormal stuff here in Canada, so much so that I had to narrow things down a bit. This book doesn't include a section on Sasquatch, for instance, because there are so many people doing that research. I'm actually going to look at Sasquatch in some of the less frequently mentioned areas of Bigfoot in a future work. I don't talk about Champ because, again, that's being very ably researched by another researcher. I didn't get into the Wendigo lore because BTF has just released a really good book on the Wendigo that covers it in extreme detail. And I didn't talk hauntings because Canadians have ghosts everywhere. It's like, that's another whole book too.
Sure.
At least one, probably more than one. You could probably write one for every province in Canada.
I'm sure.
And there's still plenty of weirdness to have happen in Canada. And I know that, time is growing short, but, I have to say that my absolute favorite thing in this book was something that caught me completely flat-footed. I'd never heard of this before. I mentioned John Worm's Strange Creatures Seldom Seen, and he's a cryptozoologist who has apparently pretty deep contacts into the First Nations people in Manitoba. And such that they're actually willing to talk to him about these things where they wouldn't ordinarily be willing to talk about them. The elders, he talks about how the elders tell them, you don't discuss this stuff. It's not, it's between you and whatever it is that you saw. But you have that tension where you've seen something incredible and you really, really want to tell somebody.
Yeah.
So John Worms has a whole section in this book on giant beavers, which is something I had never heard. Apparently, there are a number, and you got to remember that the people who are giving this testimony are people who hunt and trap and fish, not only, as part of their the way they make money, but as a means of survival. This is how they feed their families a lot of times. They know the land, and they know the animals that live on the land, and they know what a beaver looks like. John Worms was talking to, he first got into this because there were these mysterious holes that were being found on the reserves, large 3-foot diameter holes with smooth sides, right? Mm-hmm. And they couldn't figure out where these things were. He couldn't figure out where these things were coming from. And the native people were like, oh, well, the snakes live in there. He's like, what? Yeah, there's giant snakes and they live in there. It's like, okay, but where did the tunnel come from? Because snakes can't dig tunnels. It's like, oh, well, the giant beavers dig those. Yeah, and they're very matter of fact about this, right? It's like, okay, yeah, the giant beavers did it. And he's like, giant beavers? So, yeah. If you go out to, different areas in up in the First Nations areas up here, you'll find beaver lodges that are the size of men's houses. He's like, okay. And, he wasn't sure what to make of this at first, but he kept getting reports from people that were telling him that they were seeing beavers that were the size of bears. I mean, great big beavers. And somebody actually made a statue of one of these things. And there's a picture of Worm standing in a clearing next to the statue. And the thing comes up to his shoulder, right? It's standing up on its hind legs, right? You know, there's a story of a couple of native women who are picking berries, and they see a couple of these beavers, you know, dash off of a cliff and jump into the water and go swimming around. Like I said, there's several stories about these encounters with these giant beavers. And the clincher is that Worms himself actually has an experience that he documents in the book, where he was out next to a river, again, First Nations area, reserve. He's camped out along one of the rivers. He thought, this is a place that a lot of people have said that they've seen these things. He says, I'll camp out here for a night and see what happens, right? He's like the dude who goes out and says, I'm going to camp out in this area because somebody said they saw a Sasquatch here once, right? Mm-hmm. Like, maybe I'll see a Sasquatch. Except in this case, he actually did. He saw a beaver that, you know, had a head the size of a football and that he estimated was somewhere between 6 and 7 feet long.
Wow.
And, you know, because, I mean, beavers, you know, even a large adult beaver doesn't weigh more than, you know, doesn't even weigh 100 pounds, right? And we're talking a beaver the size of a bear.
Yeah.
Literally. It's like, okay, well, you know, There's some evidence that these guys may have taken up eating fish, which is not a part of the standard beaver diet. The other thing about these guys is they're a little more aggressive than regular beavers.
I was going to say, so my experience with regular beavers are they can be quite ornery. Canoeing at night, they'll come up and slap their tail right next to your canoe and scare the heck out of you.
Oh, yeah.
They will hold their ground sometimes, amazingly so. A regular-sized beaver can be a problem if it wants to be. I cannot imagine a giant-sized beaver.
So story is a couple of native kids driving around the res. They see this beaver off in the distance, right? And they stop the car, and one dude grabs a baseball bat and says, hey, I'm going to go get dinner, right? So he goes off toward this beaver, and the closer he gets to the thing, the more he realizes how big this thing is, right? And he quickly determines that maybe he's not going to get dinner and maybe he should go back to the car because the thing turns on him and starts to chase him, right?
Wow.
He makes it back to the car, but you know, they're looking at the shoulder of this beaver through the car window, you know, and they're like, okay, that's not a normal beaver.
Yeah.
It's not the kind of thing. So of the cryptid story, all the craziness that I encountered, those are really my favorite stories.
A quick look, there were in prehistoric times giant beaver throughout the United States and Canada.
Yeah, Ohioensis castoretes, I believe it was called. And there were beavers that size that were extant in the United or in the States and in Canada, in that region, up until fairly recently. So it's entirely possible that you're dealing with a relic population of these things that people, you know, just lost track of. I mean, Canada has got one of the premier Lazarus species in the wood bison. There's a species of bison that lives up here that was labeled extinct by science, right? They said that they died out due to brucellosis and overhunting back in the 20s, I believe. And then, you know, 20 or 40 years later or whatever, a Manitoba wildlife officer is flying over a forest and sees a herd of 200 of the freaking things running around in the woods. Yeah, so if you can hide wood bison for decades, then, you know, you can hide just about anything in the Canadian wilderness, right?
Yeah, sure.
Because this is the largest land animal in North America, right? The moose is tallest, but they don't outweigh bison.
Gotcha.
You know, bison are actually bigger, weight wise. So that's a little fun story. The other thing that's just so common, because we have all of these large, deep, cold lakes. And we have large, deep, cold oceans, and Canada has the longest coastline in the world. There's all kinds of sea creatures that get reported, you know, classic sea serpent sightings, but also something that the Inuit called a nenorluk, which is like a sea lion, like stress on lion. It looks like a lion, mm-hmm. right? And you would think that it was just a native legend, right? Just a native legend. I hate it when they say that.
Right, yeah.
Except that there was a report from a British ship returning to the New World back in the 1600s, I believe. So we got, you know, sea serpents and such on both sides of the continent. And then all in lakes all across the entire country, starting in British Columbia and working its way all the way across to New Brunswick. You can find a lake that has a lake monster in it in just about every province in Canada, and sometimes more than one lake. You have Ogopogo in Okanagan, Lake Okanagan. I think it was called Bessie in Lake Erie here in Ontario. Lake Simcoe has something called Kempenfelt Bay Kelly. There's Memphrey in a lake whose name I can't even begin to pronounce in Quebec. There's Lake Utopia Monster in New Brunswick. So all throughout Canada, you can find these aquatic cryptids. And there's a number of theories about what these creatures are. A super popular one is for Ogopogo, and then Caddy, which is the creature that lives off the shore on the Pacific side, is the Zeuglodon, which is a primitive whale that people theorize it could be a relic it could be a relic population of these things. That's, you know, some of which have made their way inland and adapted to the lake waters. And considering that you have reports of people who've actually gotten close enough to this thing to touch, the reports for Caddy and Ogopogo are so similar, and the witness testimony is so consistent that you have to think that there's something that they're seeing there. Either we have a relic population of these Zeuglodons, or we have a situation like the BBC show Primeval, where these anomalies are opening up and dumping prehistoric creatures in the lakes. There's no telling what's happening, but at this point, I believe just about anything. But after reading about some of this stuff, you know, because it's literally, you know, the guy's out fishing, and it's like, oh, look, there's a lake monster. You
know? Yeah, yeah.
It's very, very common here in Canada. So we do talk about those guys. There's a lot of that. I, of course, deal with, one of my favorite topics. We talk a little bit about the Lugaroo and the man-wolf. There's some good man-wolf sightings, both from Linda Godfrey and from some other sources. Additionally, I talk about the phantom trains and phantom ships that are seen in places like Nova Scotia.
Yeah, I love those stories.
It's really, really interesting stuff. There's a great phantom ship that is seen off the coast of Nova Scotia, Northumberland Strait, I believe. People will actually call this in to the Coast Guard and stuff. There's a vessel out in the water and it's burning. And the Coast Guard has gotten so used to these reports that they actually ask them, okay, what kind of vessel are you seeing? You know, it's a sailing craft, blah, blah, blah. And it's, oh, yeah, that's the Phantom ship. Wow. Don't worry about that. It's not. Because they've actually dispatched rescue vessels from Charlottetown Harbor. And these vessels, you know, got close enough to this thing to where they could feel the heat from the fire. But they're wondering to themselves why these people that they can see running around on the rigging and stuff aren't, you know, jumping overboard, because the vessel is obviously lost, right?
Right.
You know, they could feel the heat from the flames, but when they got to within a certain distance of this thing, here's your mist again, you know, fog settles over it, and then it's gone.
Wow.
So
yeah,
there's a couple of phantom ship stories. I talk about the Mary Celeste and a related case, or not related case, but a similar case, the Resolvin, where the vessel's recovered, but nobody can find the crew, which is, you know, falls into the realm of mysterious disappearances. There's a whole section on the ferry of Nova Scotia, which relies a lot on the work of Mary Fraser, who wrote a popular folklore book about Nova Scotia. Also, the ferry of Newfoundland, where we get into Barbariety stuff, which is very similar to ferry lore in the Celtic lands, you know, Scotland, Ireland, and so forth.
Yeah.
And then some ferry sightings that have happened in other parts of the country, because the little people, as the native folk over here call them, you know, are well known to the indigenous population too, and there are sightings of them. An interesting paranormal cross reference: the native folk tell us that, and this again comes from John Worms. The native folk tell us that there are species of these, of the little people, that are slightly taller than most of the fairy type folk that they see. And these people have sort of tight, elastic, rubbery skin, and have a kind of a frog-like appearance. And I'm reading the description of this thing, and I'm thinking to myself about the Loveland Frogman.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. And going, well, it's not too far from Canada to, what's that, Ohio, right?
Yeah.
maybe one of these guys paid a visit to Loveland, because the description just really, I was like, oh yeah, that could be, you know, because they're describing this, you know, very rubbery, froggy type skin.
So I've written two books on this area here called Toad Road. That has mm-hmm. repeated paranormal encounters. And a woman called me one night, it was after midnight, this woman called me. Mm. I pick up the phone, it was an older woman, and she starts talking about all these experiences she had in the area. And she's telling me about, you know, this mysterious guy in a black car that would follow them and this sort of thing. And she said, but the thing he had to really worry about was the Toad Man. And I immediately assumed, so there was a legend that, well, there was a doctor. A doctor did live at the end of the road, and he probably was an angry guy. They called him a mad doctor. He was not. He was a, you know, respected local physician, but he probably did get mm-hmm. angry because people were partying on his property and trespassing all the time because of this, you know, legend trippers and so forth. So he probably mm-hmm. was an angry guy. So I assume she meant him. And at some point I realized, like, wait, you're not talking about Dr. Belknap. She's like, oh, no, I'm talking about the Toad Man that lived in the creek that would come out. And I said, well, did you see this? And she got real quiet and she said, I'm not telling you I saw him, but I'm not telling you I didn't see him either. And I couldn't pull any more information up. And I kind of followed it away because the area is called Toad Road, not for any other reason. It was a tow road. It was a tow path for a canal just over mm-hmm. time. Whispering down the lane, it became Toad Road. But I dug up another report from the early 1900s of someone. Toad Road is very close to where the Susquehanna dumps out into, or rather the creek, Hudor's Creek, dumps out into the Susquehanna River there. And it was someone mm-hmm. on the river, maybe a mile or two north of there, on the banks of the river. And they see what they call it, a fish man, stand up and mm-hmm. walk out of the water. And I thought, Toad Man, fish man, you know, these things aren't terribly different. So it lent credence to her report. But yeah, I'm fascinated by these frogmen. And they are not as common, but still found in folklore in the Far East. They're found the Hasterman in, I think, Slavic folklore and so forth. So there mm-hmm. there are, you know, there are frogman accounts across the world. So yeah.
I just thought it was fascinating that, you know, you had this description of this creature that was very similar to something that was described in another area.
Yeah.
Now, I just love these cross-reference things that pop up.
Yeah, comparative folklore is just, it's a joy. I just love it so much.
Yeah. It's almost all way too much fun, yeah.
Travis Watson, he writes under the name of W.T. Watson. You can find his books anywhere you get books. Amazon or your local bookstores can order them in. He's got the Black Dog book. You've got Mysteries in the Mist. You've got
Canadian Monsters and Mysteries.
Canadian Monsters and Mysteries and a fiction book. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I wrote a novel a while back called Hunting the Beast, which is also on my Amazon author page.
All right. And more on the way, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, my current project is, as I said, one of the things that I said in the conclusion to the Canadian Monsters and Mysteries book is that it seems to me that researchers in the United States, you know, they look north of the border and all they see is a sheet of ice, and they don't think anything is happening up here. and part of the reason that I wrote this book was to alert people to the fact that there's plenty of weirdness, no matter what kind of weirdness you're interested in, whether it's, you know, cryptid weirdness or UFO weirdness. We didn't even get into UFOs. We had Shag Harbor and the Falcon Lake incident that happened here in Canada, both of which are well-documented, very strong UFO stories. So I wanted to make people aware that, those things that you're interested in don't stop at the Canadian border. They're happening up here. And as I was doing the research for this book and looking at some of the Sasquatch lore before I decided that I couldn't really include that here, you know, a lot of people think that, just like they think that Sasquatch only, those stories only happen in the Pacific Northwest, you know, Oregon, Washington, Northern California, and so forth. And we know that that's not true. It's not true in Canada either. There's plenty of Sasquatch goodness happening outside of British Columbia. And I've been looking at reports in places like Manitoba and Ontario and so forth, and there's some doozies. So that looks like it's going to be my next project.
Excellent. Well, I've loved everything you've done so far. Looking forward to what you bring out in the future. And thanks for coming on Strange Familiars.
Well, thank you for having me, Tim. And good wishes to your listeners.
"90 Days to the Perfect Puppy" can help you with all of your puppy training needs. They have a relationship-based approach to training, which helps you and your puppy become perfect for each other. It's not about changing your puppy, forcing them into a mold. You and your puppy become perfect for each other. You kind of meet in the middle. You learn how to become perfect for each other. They have online sources, video lessons, a secret Facebook group, and of course, one-on-one options are available as well. You can find 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy at sidhappens.us. Let them help you understand how your dog thinks and apply proactive training methods so you and your puppy can become perfect for each other. With your puppies having problems with mouthing and biting, potty training, fear and nervousness, barking, chewing on furniture, shoes, or other things they shouldn't be chewing on, crate training, hyperactivity issues, leash training, or more, 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy can help you. They can teach you what to do and also what not to do. Again, you can find them at sidhappens.us. Look for the 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy link at the top of the page. The Little Leather Library.
It's not what you think.
Reminds me of, so one of the hermits, and we've done a show on him, I think it was a patron show. Mm-hmm. One of the hermits that I'm writing about in the hermit book is known as the Leather Man.
You have a search set for that.
I have a search set for that. His photos are prohibitively expensive, which is why I had to do a full page illustration of him for the book.
There's a guy, though, in Finland named Tom, who's a leather man as well, and his pictures go for not as much sometimes.
Yeah, that's the problem with that search. That search leads to some results that aren't exactly the hermit I was looking for. Let me just say that. But this little leather book is not either of those things.
This is a series that they did. It's quite literal. They're just little leather books that are classics. There's a whole series of them. I think this one dates, I think, to the 30s.
It very much is a little leather book, but it's Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll, and it has, I believe these are the original.
Are they the Tenniel
illustrations, I believe.
But book. It's tiny. It's like maybe 4x3, I think. I don't have a ruler here, but I'm going to go with
3.5x.
Let's get out the ruler. It's right. Do you have a ruler over there?
Damn, you frame woman. So for the noise factor, I'm going to edit that section out. But Allison got up and measured, and it is indeed 4x3. She's very good with that because she worked at a frame shop in the past, and she's very good with measurements. and estimates. So she hit the nail on the head. So this will be our curiosity of the week, the Little Leather Library volume of Alice in Wonderland. If you go to the show notes for this episode at strangefamiliars.com, you will see an image of this. You can click on that. It will take you to our Etsy shop where you can purchase this and a few other curiosities of the week.
I just added a lot of photos in the past week, some memorial things.
On Etsy?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even notice.
Apparently you're not the only one. They're still all there.
Oh, so yes, Allison's added a bunch of extra photos. If you like the artwork for this episode, the Bigfoot creature in the mist, Wild Man in the Mist, that will be in the Etsy shop. The episode artwork usually sells pretty quickly.
I really like this one.
So run, do not walk, to the Etsy shop if you want to own the original for that. Also at Etsy, we have Strange Familiars t-shirts. The High Strangeness Tour shirts are completely sold out. But we do have the original Awoken Tree shirts. Plenty of sizes available for that.
And a new empty box in the house, which is a delight.
Exactly.
Someplace to put more junk.
We have artwork, both originals and prints. We have copies of my books. All of my books are available on Etsy. If you get them there, they come signed. Strange Familiar stickers, patches, and much more. Our shop name is Lost Grave. That's one word. But if you type in Strange Familiars in Etsy, you should see our stuff come up. While you're on Etsy, check out our friends at Karmic Garden and Chad Shop, Ruck Rabbit Outdoors. I believe that's it for this week. We will be back soon with more Strange Familiars. Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts, music, books, art, podcasts, and more. Intro and background music is by Stone Breath. If you want to hear more or purchase music, you can go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com. Strange Familiars is on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars, where you can join the Strange Familiars gathering group. And we're on Instagram, @strangefamiliars, one word. Please give us a follow. And you can find us on the web, always at strangefamiliars.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.